Hello and welcome to the IEA podcast. I'm Emma Revel, Head of Communications at the Institute of Economic Affairs, and we're recording on the 9th of April 2020. You can subscribe to the IEA podcast on Apple, Spotify and Podbean, and while you're there, don't forget to check out our extensive back catalogue. You can also subscribe to our new newsletter, IEA Daily, and never miss an episode. Coronavirus has focused the world's attention on national health services. A big part of the British government's messaging is protect the NHS, drawing people's attention to the need to keep the number of people requiring hospital treatment as low as possible so the NHS is able to cope. There's been an outpouring of affection and appreciation for health and social care workers, drawing people onto the streets for a weekly flurry of clapping. But attention has also been turned to other healthcare systems. In a debate where the UK and US systems are often seen as the only possible models, people are learning, and possibly being misled, about the variety of other healthcare systems used across the world. Germany has especially been singled out as a system that's purported to be performing relatively well under immense pressure. The country is conducting significantly more tests than most other countries, and their mortality rate at present is low. People are asking why the UK's testing capability seems so far behind. Is it a case of different priorities, or is the social insurance model and decentralised system behind Germany's coronavirus response? To discuss this further, I'm joined today by Dr. Christian Niemitz, Head of Political Economy at the IEA and author of numerous reports on the National Health Service and indeed other healthcare models. Christian, many people are discussing the German healthcare system all of a sudden, and yet understanding of how the system differs from the NHS can be quite limited. Can you explain how the Germans manage their healthcare system differently to the Brits? Why is it that they seem more able to respond to coronavirus, especially when it comes to testing?
Right. So the big difference is that the German system is not a national health service. There is no state-provided, no state-run health service. There is no equivalent to the NHS. It's a mandatory insurance system. Everybody has to have insurance. And you can choose between about 100 insurers. You can choose between different insurance policies. You always have to cover a certain minimum package. That's what all insurers have to offer. Everybody has to get. And then your insurer would cover most of your healthcare costs. Now, when you say insurance, a lot of people think about the US system instinctively. It isn't like that at all. It is a social insurance system, and that means that the insurance premiums that you pay are not related to your individual health risks. So it doesn't matter what your medical history is, it doesn't matter what your medical risk factors are, your premium would always be the same. Your premium does not go up if you are exceptionally unhealthy, and it doesn't go down if you are exceptionally healthy. It's not related to individual health status. It is instead related to income in the German system. Now, that's a political choice. There are social insurance systems which do that in a different way. Switzerland has a similar system, but they don't peg it to income. There, it's just a flat fee. In the Netherlands, it's a mix of the two. It has a flat element and an income-related, income-dependent element. In the German system, it's a percentage of income. It's a bit less than 14%. Of income, and that's notionally split between employers and employees. And that simply means that somebody who earns a lot pays a lot. Up to there is an upper limit, but broadly speaking, rich people pay a lot more than poor people. It is a progressively financed system in that sense. And then on the health provider side, healthcare provision is mostly private. For example, in the hospital sector, there are public hospitals, but their market share is only about 40%. So most hospitals are private. And the public hospitals are not run by the national government either. Public would then mean they're either run by a local council, municipal hospitals, or they would be run by a state, a regional government. And there can be big differences from state to state. For example, some states have privatized almost all of their hospitals. Some have kept a large number of state-run hospitals. So depending on regional political preferences, there can be big differences. But on the whole, about 60% of the hospital sector is private. And private in this case can mean for-profit. It can be a for-profit corporation. There are hospital chains, and there are also big charitable providers. So around one in four hospitals or so are owned by a church. The Catholic Church is a big healthcare provider. The Protestant Church is a big healthcare provider. That has historical origins. That is simply the way most healthcare in much of the world has developed. That was once true in Britain as well, that hospitals were originally often linked to a church or religious organization. It's just that here that all disappeared with the wholesale nationalization of healthcare in the late 1940s and the creation of the National Health Service in countries that have a system more like the German one, that tradition was kept. So those church-owned hospitals simply became integrated into the social insurance model. They had to become a bit more formalized, but they could basically keep their identity. So it is a pluralistic system in that sense. You have lots of different providers who can have very different organizational and corporate philosophies. And different medical philosophies, they're very different approaches. That's true on the provider side. Specialists would be either employed by a hospital or self-employed. GPs are self-employed, like here. So that means that very little healthcare is publicly provided, and most of it isn't publicly funded either. There is, if you have no income of your own whatsoever, then the government would pay your insurance premium. In that sense, there is a tax-funded element in it. But otherwise, healthcare is mostly paid through those insurance contributions, and those are related to incomes.
Okay, much more decentralized system than in the UK. Andrew Neil is one of the people who has brought attention to the German system on social media. He's been tweeting about it quite a lot in recent weeks. And in a tweet last week, he said that such a system could never be adopted in Britain because it's a two-tier system. Is that an accurate characterization? Like, are rich Germans able to access better healthcare than poor Germans?
He's not completely wrong about that. There is a two-tier element, but we have to be clear about where this comes from. The social insurance system that I've just described is not a two-tier system. That's a very egalitarian system. In that system, the only source of inequality would be that if you're rich, you can afford additional healthcare services, things that are not covered by statutory insurance. But then that is in principle true in Britain as well. It's not that private healthcare is banned in Britain. It's just very much a niche sector, a luxury sector. And it's true here as well that if you're rich, you can buy additional healthcare. In the German system, the hurdles to that would be lower because there isn't this strict separation between public and private or statutory and voluntary. The reason why private healthcare is very limited here is that you have to, if you want to access private healthcare, you have to exit one healthcare system, which is the NHS, and enter a parallel healthcare system, which would be the private one, and they would be running side by side. In the German system, that wouldn't be the way it works. It's more that that statutory insurance would cover a certain package, but it could be that a doctor tells you, look, there is this new innovative treatment that's available, but that is not going to be covered by statutory insurance. So if you want that, you will have to pay extra. But it's not that you exit one system and enter a different system. It's more that you get most of your healthcare through the statutory system, and you can then top up or upgrade things here and there. That would be a source of inequality. But for the basic package, it's a very egalitarian system. What makes it two-tier in some respects is that some people can opt out of that social insurance model that I've described. That model doesn't cover everybody. That only covers about 90% of the population. The other 10% can opt out. That's about just over 8 million people. And when you opt out, that doesn't mean that you have no health insurance. Everybody has to have some health insurance. What it means is that you then have to get conventional commercial health insurance. And once you have commercial health insurance, then you pay risk-related premiums. Now, the reason why the statutory system, the social health insurance system, is relatively expensive is simply that it covers everybody, including the very worst risks, including the very poorest, whose insurance premiums are never going to cover their costs. You are cross-subsidizing those people. If you are in the social insurance system and you are in reasonably good health, most of the premium that you pay isn't really for you. It's cross-subsidizing other people. It's cross-subsidizing people in much worse health and people who are poorer than you. Most of your premium would be for that. That's what makes it expensive. But if you opt out and if you enter this parallel commercial private insurance system, there you don't have to subsidize anyone. You only pay for your own healthcare needs. Now, the people who opt out are on average healthier and wealthier. That's why that parallel system is substantially better funded relative to the healthcare needs of the people in it. And that is why the people in that parallel system can get top-notch healthcare. Once you're in that branch of the system, there you can really get the absolute best that is medically possible, the absolute top quality. And yes, that you could describe as a two-tier system, but that is an accidental feature of the system, you could say. If you didn't have those opt-out clauses, if nobody could opt out, then it would not be a two-tier system. And indeed, other countries that have similar systems don't allow this opt-out, and therefore they don't have a two-tier system. Switzerland has an otherwise very similar system, but they don't have this distinction between social insurance and commercial private insurance. There, everybody is in the social insurance system. The Netherlands, similar story. They once had the same division, but they closed it at some point. So there, 100% of the population are in the social insurance system. Everybody has to subsidize the people in worse health and the people who are poorer than them. And that's why this super well-funded luxury healthcare sector, if you want to call it that, doesn't exist in those places.
Okay, so I mean, the UK could quite easily learn lessons from how Germany run their system without, it wouldn't necessarily mean adopting a two-tier system, because that's not a necessary part of how the German system functions. It's just an additional part.
Yes, that's exactly right. I'd say even if Germany adopted that system today, if they didn't have it and came up with that idea today, they wouldn't do it in that way again. That's a complete historical accident. That's rooted in the politics of the 1880s when that system was first introduced. What happened then was that the system wasn't originally meant to be universal. It was only for selected groups. Namely employees in the private sector, and even then not everybody. It was fairly limited initially, and that meant that the self-employed, for example, or civil servants were not covered by that system, but they still wanted to get insurance as well. So that's why a commercial, conventional private health insurance model developed alongside the social insurance system. And it's just that the social insurance system grew over time. By the time of the First World War, roughly, it had become a nearly universal system. And that's when people started to realize, oh, hang on, this is a bit odd that we have these two systems here side by side. It's just that by then, both were so big that there would have been political resistance to changing it then. It was then already too late. Once you have, and that's the situation now, when you have 8 million people in that sector and you have a well-developed industry and it just works in a very different way, it is then politically difficult to say, right, we're abolishing that system now, or we're integrating it into the other system where we're unifying and streamlining it now. That's something that you wouldn't introduce deliberately, but once you have it, it's hard to overcome it. But
yeah,
it is,
I mean,
really,
it's an entrenched quirk of the system. It's not a feature that makes it function.
Absolutely, yeah. So, it has to do with the politics of the 1880s, and Chancellor Bismarck at the time wanted to tie the labor movement closer to the state, because they didn't identify very much with the state, with the nation state at the time. The German nation state was then a very new thing, had only been set up 12 years earlier. So that was Bismarck's way of trying to get the working class on board. So it was pure politics, but in circumstances that are completely uncomparable to the situation we have today.
Interesting. I think we could do a whole other podcast of the German politics of the 1880s. So Jeremy Cliff of the New Statesman, also on Twitter, has made a more left-wing case for the German system, arguing that it's easier to spend money on healthcare there than it is in Britain, because the decision lies with insurers whether or not to spend additional funds. It doesn't have to go through the political manoeuvres that an NHS spending increase would have to go through in the UK. Do the people who advocate for a German-style system in the UK, or at least features of the German system, realise that they're advocating for actually higher healthcare spending, not less money for the NHS?
Not sure if all of them do, but if they don't, I'd say that isn't something they should be worried about. I'm not particularly interested in what the total level of healthcare spending should be. I don't have a view on this. If somebody asked me, should it be 10% of GDP, 11%, 12%, I couldn't answer that question. I'm more interested in having a system in which you have some control over how much you want to spend on healthcare. And that exists to some extent in the German system, although this is better in the neighbor countries. This will be better in Switzerland and the Netherlands, where they allow you greater scope over how much, how extensive you want your coverage and your freedom of choice to be. And as long as you can quite easily reduce your healthcare costs, as long as there are lower cost options available, I don't have a problem with healthcare spending in total being quite high. In the German system, you can reduce your healthcare premium if you want to. For example, there are insurers, I think even all insurers, offer, for example, a model where healthcare would be a bit more like in Britain, where you have to register with a GP and your GP would be a gatekeeper, meaning you can't directly go to a specialist. You cannot directly access the more expensive and more specialized types of healthcare. You have to go to a GP first and get a referral. That is maybe less convenient, but if you do that, if you go for such an insurance policy, then your premium will go down. If you don't value that direct access to specialists very much, if you are okay with having less freedom of choice, then you can reduce your healthcare spending quite substantially. And that is even more the case in some of the neighbor countries. In Switzerland, you can go for a model where you waive your freedom of choice almost completely initially. You have to go in first instance to an integrated healthcare center, and you can only go to healthcare providers outside of that if you get a referral from them, but that would be your first point of call. And if much the way it was in Britain before the Blair years, that you would get a referral from a GP. The GP would make the choice for you, and you wouldn't have a lot of choice. And that is the sort of thing that you can opt into in some social insurance system where you have less choice, but your premium also then goes down, because systems with less choice are generally cheaper. Choice is something that drives our costs. But if it then turns out that most people don't want to go for those lower cost options, and most people don't want to reduce their insurance premium, that they really want the full package, even if that costs more, then I'm absolutely okay with that. If that means that in total spending is higher than it otherwise would be, then I'd say, so what? The part of the reason why spending is higher in some of those systems, not all, but some, certainly in the German system, is competition between the insurers. That is, we normally associate competition with lower prices, but that's only true if you have price-sensitive consumers, if you have consumers who are shopping around for lower prices. In some cases, that's not our main priority. In some cases, we are more interested in additional services and higher quality. And if that's what providers compete on, then competition isn't going to result in lower prices. In the German case, insurers do to some extent compete on premiums, but they also compete on how much they offer. They all have to offer the minimum package, but most go beyond, and most offer things that are not, strictly speaking, medically necessary. You can get mumbo jumbo on through the statutory health insurance system. Some insurers offer homeopathy, for example, where if that happened here, we would be opposed to that, because we would say, hang on, this is taxpayers' money. You cannot spend taxpayers' money on fashionable mumbo jumbo. This has no proven clinical benefits. People can pay for that as a hobby, but that is not the role of the healthcare system. Whereas in the German case, it would be considerably harder to argue against that, because you can then say, well, if you don't like that, you can just go to an insurer that doesn't offer homeopathy, and then what's your problem? And in the same way, some insurers offer things like aromatherapy, massage therapy, things that we wouldn't think of as healthcare, but more as wellness, as leisure services, things that we would associate with maybe a gym rather than a healthcare facility, since insurers compete on those things, along those dimensions. Some of them offer those services. And yes, that drives up overall costs. I don't particularly have a problem with that, but we have to be clear about that. That is the reason why costs are lower. A system like that is not necessarily going to result in lower costs. It would if, let's say, we introduced the exact same system here today, with people's preferences being what they are. It could be that since people here are not used to having luxury services covered by the healthcare system, that there wouldn't be much demand for these optional extras, and that therefore most people would go for a more minimalistic health insurance policy, doing only the required minimum and not going beyond that. And then with a system like that, total spending would be substantially lower. So that is possible. It just depends on people's preferences. But nonetheless, I found it quite interesting that Jeremy Cliff made that case, that he made a case for the German system from a left-wing perspective, because he writes for the New Statesman, which is a left-wing magazine. You would expect them to be fiercely protective of the NHS, and I'm guessing most of his colleagues would be. I guess the point he's trying to make is that he is mostly interested in getting up healthcare spending. He thinks we should spend more on healthcare, and he thinks that is easier to do in a German style system. And that is actually a fair argument. It is true that the point that he makes is that in Britain, people say they love the NHS. We go out and clap for the NHS, and we put love NHS into our social media profiles. We signal to other people how much we love the healthcare system, but we don't automatically vote for the political parties that promise the biggest increase in healthcare spending. So it's almost a bit like the stated preferences, revealed preferences distinction. We say we love the NHS, but that doesn't mean that we're really prepared to pay much more in taxes. Whereas if you had a system like the German one, it would be a lot easier to raise healthcare spending, because it doesn't go through the government. It doesn't go through the hands of politicians. The money that you pay would go directly to insurers. Politicians don't get their hands on it. And I guess if we had a system like that, people would be prepared to spend more. And for the same reason that if we had a dedicated NHS tax, and if you could absolutely guarantee that money is really ring-fenced, that it will not be diverted to, I don't know, HS2 or some public health project or development aid or other less popular things, then most people would be prepared to spend more if you could absolutely guarantee it. And it's just the problem with so-called ring-fenced taxes is of course that you can never really guarantee it. Politicians at the end of the day can spend money on whatever they like. Whereas if you have a system like the German one, then it's more, the premiums that you pay are more like the BBC license fee. It's sort of comparable to a tax, in a sense that you can't opt out of it unless you really have absolutely nothing that that can receive TV signals. But it is nonetheless not a tax in a sense that it goes to the government. It goes directly to the organization it's meant to go to. It's ring-fenced, and you can compare healthcare premiums in the German system or in similar systems elsewhere to that.
Okay. We're still quite early on in the coronavirus crisis, and we don't know how the next few months will go. But as someone who's argued passionately for reform of British healthcare to improve efficiency and bring up outcomes for patients, do you worry that the current outpouring of support for the NHS, which is absolutely valid for people working under unimaginable pressure to save lives on a scale most of them have never seen before, do you think that will shield people from seeing where improvements in the NHS can still be made?
It could go either way. It's hard to tell at the moment. There are two competing tendencies. One is, as you mentioned, that there is suddenly this media interest in other healthcare systems that didn't exist before. I've been writing about healthcare for ages, and the whole time it's always been the main obstacle to a sensible discussion is that everyone thinks there is just the NHS or the US system. There is nothing else. Nothing else really features in the debate. And now suddenly you get mainstream journalists talking about alternatives. Andrew Neil, there I'm less surprised in his case. He may have said something like that maybe 5 years ago, but I wouldn't have expected someone from the New Statesman to praise a relatively market-based healthcare system 5 years ago. So there is this renewed interest among or completely new interest among mainstream journalists. That is a novelty that didn't exist before. Suddenly it seems to have become mainstream to talk about other healthcare systems. I'm glad that this is happening. I've been trying for years, not with a lot of success. Shame it took a pandemic, but if it happens, then maybe that would be the one small silver lining here. The other tendency, the countervailing tendency, is what you mentioned, the increasing deification of the NHS. The problem here is that NHS purists, people who want to shut down debates about alternatives or fundamental reforms, have always been very good at insinuating that if you criticize the NHS, you're really in some way attacking doctors and nurses. Now, this is, of course, totally absurd. This would be like saying if you criticize a planned economy, this is an attack on ordinary Russians or ordinary Cubans. Clearly, you're talking about the system rather than individual people within it. But that in panel discussions, and I've been in this situation a couple of times, that point is can be hard to get across. And NHS purists have always been good at instrumentalizing and co-opting this feeling of gratitude that people have towards doctors and nurses, both the professional respect, but also specifically in a situation like now, the sense of gratitude, which is totally justified, but which we should not confuse with the defense of any one particular healthcare model. Of course, if we adopted a completely different system overnight, the same doctors and the same nurses would still be there. The physical assets would still be there. The professional relations could continue. Nobody is talking about changing any of that. But we'll have to see how it plays out. There are these two competing factors at the moment. It has become mainstream to talk about alternatives, and that's great. But it has also strengthened this religious reverence for the NHS, which has been there for decades, and I guess a book could be written about how that developed in the first place, then that would be a fascinating case study. But wherever it comes from, it's there now. For now, we're stuck with it.
We're in this strange situation of solidifying support for the NHS while at the same time highlighting that other systems do in fact exist. You're interested in finding out about different healthcare systems across the world, if you visit Apple, Spotify or Podbean for the IEA podcasts, you can search for the episode entitled Why Has No Other European Country Copied the NHS Model? While you're there, don't forget to subscribe to IEA podcasts. Or you can visit the IEA website and download a report called Diagnosis Overrated, an analysis of structural flaws within the NHS.